Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guests today are Lenore Brayford and Paula Drake, co-founders of Piedmont Farm Animal Refuge. Nestled in Pittsboro, North Carolina, Piedmont Farm is a sanctuary dedicated to housing rescued farm animals, educating people about the grim realities of animal agriculture, and promoting veganism. On Talking Animals over the years, we've highlighted a number of farm animal sanctuaries that pursue a comparable mission, but there are two notable distinctions here. Number one, Piedmont Farm Animal Refuge is a highly innovative animal sanctuary, chiefly owing to Paul Drake being an architectural designer. Consequently, each structure at Piedmont Farm is uniquely tailored to the species housed there, reflecting their behavioral inclinations and preferences. And number two, related to number one, Piedmont Farm Animal Refuge is the subject of a major new documentary, Forever Home, by award-winning filmmaker Allison Argo. Past guests on Talking Animals a couple times over the recent years. So the film represents a rich profile of Brayford and Drake, a couple with contrasting yet complementary personalities. He's a creative dreamer, she's a disciplined realist, illustrating how they fashion singularly accommodating quarters for the goats, who for instance flourish in vertical spaces, and the chickens and the sheep. We also see a new residence take shape in the film when they decide to additionally rescue cows, once again puzzling out where and how to construct a residence wholly customized for that species to live a fulfilled, happy life. We'll delve into the enchanting world of Piedmont Farm Animal Refuge when I speak with Lenore Brayford and Paul Drake here in just a moment on Talking Animals on WNF. Coming up later on today's program, I'll speak with Christina Antonio, Director of Community Engagement and Animal Rescue Coalition, or ARC, a longtime Sarasota organization devoted to reducing pet overpopulation, other forms of animal care, and helping place adoptable animals in homes. To that end, they've organized the upcoming Ark Walk, dog-friendly, multifaceted event happening Saturday, May 3rd at Payne Park in downtown Sarasota. We'll learn more on this later when Christina joins us on Talking Animals on WNF. Right now, though, let's get into our conversation about Piedmont Farm Animal Refuge with Lenore and Paul. All three, in a sense, star in this new documentary, Forever Home. With a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing DJ at WNF.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Lenore Brayford and Paul Drake to Talking Animals. Good morning, Lenore and Paul.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having us.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals, and congratulations on you and the refuge being profiled in Forever Home, this new documentary by Allison Argo, a really celebrated and acclaimed veteran filmmaker. So, and I hasten to add, this is not a film examining multiple farm sanctuaries in which Piedmont Farm is included. The movie is totally about you two and the refuge, so that's something quite significant. It does raise some key questions, though, starting with, how did this documentary come about?
It started, actually, when I was attending a film screen of one of Allison Argo's previous movies called The Last Pig, which is a beautiful movie that everyone should see. And I was talking to Allison after the movie and telling her how much I loved how the movie captured pigness, what we call pigness, just like being a pig and what that's like. And I told her about some of my work and how my architecture focuses on the animals here, the specific farm animals that we designed for here at the refuge. And she became very interested in that and said, maybe I should make a documentary on that.
Just off the top of her head, just in that sort of post-screening conversation, that's what she said?
Yeah.
Wow.
And we didn't really know if she was serious, but then she called us up, you know, a few months later and was like, hey, you want to actually do it? So, yeah.
So really, it was kind of something you suggested, not something that somebody brought to you and said, hey, we have this idea. It was really just kind of the spur of the moment conversation that, because you were so impressed with the pig film that she made.
That's right. Yeah. But it was also her interest in what we were doing. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I guess given how knocked out you were by that film, when that circled back around to being an actual possibility, were you guys both totally enthusiastic about it? Or did you have any kind of mixed feelings at all about proceeding with a film like that?
Well, I think because we had seen some of her previous work, we knew the quality and the sensitivity that she had
sure.
with regards to animals and also working with humans. And so I think that gave us an initial, you know, sense of ease and wanting to move forward. But neither of us really enjoy being on the screen. So that was something that we had.
That was partly why I was asking. Because nothing really about Allison's work, who, of course, is a fantastic filmmaker and does just amazing work and has for many, many years. But yeah, I was kind of more thinking you guys might drag your heels about we're not really the on-screen people, and this is going to be on-screen quite a bit, number one. And, you know, it's almost like agreeing to do a major profile with a publication. You think, well, this will help the sanctuary, but am I really comfortable spending that kind of time and talking about myself that much, et cetera, et cetera. So that's kind of more why I was asking about your initial thoughts.
Yeah, I think that neither of us are really prone to, you know, wanting to be in that role, but I think we understood the potential that the film could bring to help get the word out about not only our sanctuary, but farm animals on the whole and kind of
yeah.
you know, what they go through in our society. And I think there also was a level of trust that we were able to develop with Allison over the years that this film was in production. And I think that really helped us. And, you know, she was very open with us and, you know, willing to listen to feedback. And so I think that trust was essential.
And how many years did the whole process span from that first conversation after the screening of The Last Pig to, you know, now just now rolling out to for people to see?
I believe that screening was in 2017 or 2018, and she might have started filming here in maybe 2019, and then COVID hit and things got delayed.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was a kind of a long process, yeah.
Yeah, seems like COVID or no COVID, the world of documentary films often spans a lot of years for a lot of different reasons. People have to, you know, go generate some more dough or do another project and come back to this one, and there's all kinds of reasons they get protracted like that. But well, let me ask you this, to what extent does it present a portrayal of you and the refuge that you recognize? I mean, to what extent does it feel like how you see yourselves when you see the film now?
I think we would both say that we feel it's fairly accurate, both with regard to the sanctuary and us. You know, there's a few things in there that there's a particular scene where Paul and I are kind of going back and forth over the size of the cow house. And it's sort of a moment of comedy in the film. Both of us, you know, it goes on for quite a long time and it's kind of drawn out.
She wants it to be bigger and I want it to be smaller because I have to build it.
Yeah. So, you know, maybe in real life it wouldn't have been quite like that. But, and, you know, when we initially saw the film, we're like, oh, that's boring. You know, it needs to be cut out and, you know, people are not going to enjoy that. But then after the first initial kind of pilot screening, everybody said, oh, we thought that part was so funny and we loved it. So Allison said, good luck. We're even that in the film.
Yeah.
But I think overall we feel good about the portrayal of it and we feel it's fairly accurate.
Yeah, and one thing about that, maybe it was sort of disproportionate to the actual conversation you guys had, but to me it was also part of what becomes a little bit of a through line about, you guys are obviously a couple and have been for some time, but there's some definite contrasting, complementary but contrasting personalities, and that seemed to help kind of capture that thing of Paul has these cool ideas and sort of sometimes fanciful, and Lenora says, okay, but what about this, or we need to do this, or, you know, let's rein this in, pal, a little bit. Let's not go too nuts here. And so perhaps the cow thing was a bit exaggerated, but it seemed like it really kind of helped capture what was already presented as sort of a portrayal of the relationship and just sort of the way you guys tend to work, maybe.
Yeah, and I think it kind of clarified, you know, our strengths and how we work as a team.
Yeah.
Because we do make a good team in this work, so.
For sure.
Yeah, it's good to be able to kind of stand back and see, you know, what we've been doing and get a get a kind of bigger perspective on it. So, yeah.
Well, so most people hearing this conversation at the moment haven't had the good fortune to see the film yet. So let's talk a little bit about the beginning of that team. Let's hear the beginning of the Lenore and Paul story. Take me back to the day you guys met.
So we met technically before the first day of our college at Oberlin College.
Mm-hmm.
We were
in Ohio.
Yeah, we were sitting in the cafeteria with my parents, and Paul and his parents walked in and just sat down at the table with us. And at that time, Paul and I, being sort of shy and awkward and kind of being embarrassed by this, didn't really look much up from our plates and kind of just let our parents chat and have a nice time. And so that's technically how we met. But then over the next several months, we would run into each other through different circles. It's a small college campus. We were in the same dorm. And the next semester we started dating. But yeah, we like to joke that it was an arranged marriage and that our parents met before we did.
Yeah, by sitting down at the table like that, and it was, sounds like there was slightly awkward response from the two of you when people plopped down that way.
Oh yeah, we were horrified about our parents talking to other people. Yes.
Yeah, at that age, everything's kind of embarrassing, I guess, or horrifying in that regard. Yeah. So this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guests are Lenore Brayford and Paul Drake, co-founders of Piedmont Farm Animal Refuge, a highly innovative animal sanctuary, chiefly in regard to Drake being an architectural designer. So each structure at the refuge is uniquely tailored to the species housed there. The pair in their sanctuary are profiled in a major new documentary, Forever Home, by award-winning filmmaker Allison Argo. So if you'd like to ask Lenore or Paul a question about the refuge, about what we'll get into more about sort of the distinctive approach to creating and building those structures or anything else farm sanctuary related, please call 813-239-9663, email dj at wnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So, Lenore, if I'm not mistaken, you spent a few years volunteering and working at sanctuaries. But what was the impetus of teaming up with Paul and launching your own sanctuary?
Yeah, well, I think I originally had this idea that I wanted to start a sanctuary, but I didn't have any actual hands-on experience or knowledge for how to start a nonprofit. So that's why I spent some years, as you said, you know, looking for any opportunity I could to volunteer, do an internship, work as a caregiver in those roles to try to, you know, learn more and also learn if I actually wanted to do it. Because, you know, a lot of what you think a job might not be what it really is in reality.
Did you find that kind of eye-opening? Was it sort of more demanding and difficult than you kind of expected going in, or how did that compare to your initial expectations?
That's a good question. I don't know. I think I was young and had a lot of energy, and so I think...
Game for anything?
Yeah, I think more so I was motivated the more I spent time at various sanctuaries in those positions, the more I was motivated to just kind of stand out as an intern or volunteer, kind of be an overachiever and, you know, learn as much as I could, learn all that. Like, for example, I was an intern at Farm Sanctuary, and there's, I think, 300 to 500 animals there. And I was like, I'm going to learn all their names in the first couple of weeks so that the staff here realizes that I'm serious. And, you know, those efforts paid off, because when I did decide, okay, I think I want to do this and start this place, I had some really awesome people I'd met along the way and mentors that I could call upon when, you know, there were difficulties or questions that I had. So people knew that I was, you know, taking this seriously. I had done my research, and that was extremely helpful to me.
And did you learn all their names quickly?
I did.
Wow.
I made a little diagram of a map and drew all the different barns and structures, and I would fill in the blank. And
that must have truly impressed people, though, because that's a lot of animals to know their names, and that's great. So with that experience, were the conversations that you had initially and then maybe had more when you developed that experience, was it always thinking we want to do a sanctuary that whatever we learn out there working or interning at other sanctuaries is going to reflect Paul's architectural design background. I mean, was that kind of what you were trying to work your way back to by getting that experience, or was that sort of come later in the process?
No, I would say that sort of organically arose out of the two of us and the situation that we were in. So I was starting the sanctuary. Paul was going to school at NC State to get a master's in architecture. And it was sort of just a natural marriage of, well, what does the sanctuary need? What are Paul's skills, and what are some of the projects he's working on at school?
Yeah, so I was able to get credit, school credit, for designing some of the structures and actually building the goat and sheep houses, too, as my thesis project for my master's at NC State, which was really great for me because a lot of architecture school is kind of, you know, making great designs and building models and stuff for things that are never, ever going to be realized.
Sort of theoretical, but you don't actually put it in practice, I guess, or?
Exactly. Yeah. And I'm kind of a hands-on person. And so it was a great kind of marriage of my my skills and to be able to actually build something that I designed was really unique and special for me at that time. And so that's what evolved into animal-centered design, was researching about the animals, learning as much as we can about them, and then trying to design spaces around their lifestyles. That's what developed during that time. But I think, back to your question, when Lenore started the sanctuary, we really had no idea that would happen.
That's really interesting that it really was that organic, yeah. So it looks like we might have a caller that wants to get in on the conversation right now, so let's invite them in and we'll come back to some more questions. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Lenore and Paul.
Yes, I have a question. I was listening to you about how you got started with the sanctuary, and I'm somebody who calls into Duncan's show quite frequently and have considered and always wanted to start a sanctuary myself. However, I'm getting to be, I'm on the generation dividing line between oldest millennial and youngest Gen Xer, and I just don't know if it would be feasible at this point in my life to start another sanctuary. Have you guys ever heard of, or would you ever consider something like, I'll call it a satellite location? So somebody who, I know you're in North Carolina, I'm in Florida, but I mean, I'm not talking about me specifically, but I'm wondering if you know of any sanctuaries that do that, where like, somebody only has capacity, let's say, for, I don't know, 25 animals. They really cannot go over 25 animals. But there's maybe a larger sanctuary in the same state or the same region of the country that, you know, is willing to partner with them. I don't know. It looks like you've got a really great website, by the way. I don't know who's doing your website, but that is really eye-catching.
Oh, well, thanks for your question. And I think it's wonderful that, you know, you're even thinking about starting a sanctuary and wanting to help farm animals, because they really need all the help they can get in our world. And yeah, we don't have any kind of a satellite program. And I think for us, with our size and just the management and oversight that would be needed for that, we have been approached by a couple people in the past, and we decided not to do that at this time in our growth. But I do know of some other groups who, either through like a foster, like a heavy foster program, maybe there isn't even an actual sanctuary, but instead there's a network of people who foster farm animals, and those often end up being animals who live there for many years, unfortunately. I've seen that model before. And then some of the really big sanctuaries, like Farm Sanctuary in particular, they have multiple sanctuary sites. They have a small satellite sanctuary outside of their larger New York sanctuary as well. So I think it would probably be a larger sanctuary that might have the capacity to take something like that on, or maybe a slightly different model like the foster system.
Or there's also what are called micro sanctuaries, which is basically just what it sounds like. Somebody who doesn't have a lot of space but wants to help animals. And there's a whole kind of network of micro sanctuaries as well.
Oh, thank you. I've never heard that term. I will definitely look that up. Do you have any idea what the minimum acreage is for something like that? Like, you have to have at least 5 acres or 10 acres for farm animals?
So in terms of a micro sanctuary, people who live in New York City and have one chicken in their apartment could technically be considered a micro sanctuary. So there's no, you know, real definition about that, and except for some of the ethics around it and what does it mean to be a sanctuary, you know, versus an exploitive situation. But yeah, in terms of space for certain species, it would really depend on where you live, what kind of zoning you have, you know, what kind of local regulations there might be for your county.
And what kind of species that you want to rescue too. Because obviously chickens and maybe ducks will take up a lot less space than, say, goats and sheep.
All right. Well, thank you very much, and thank you for what you do.
Thanks for your call. Appreciate it.
Yep.
All right, let's take one more quick call, and then we're going to get back to some of my questions. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Lenore and Paul. Hello, it's you. Oh, no, it's not, I guess. All right, maybe you'll call back. 813-239-9663. So our caller's question kind of brings me to, I guess, how did you decide on your location there in Pittsboro, North Carolina? Did you have a history or particular connection there, or did it simply involve a good deal on land that you guys felt would be appropriate for a sanctuary, or what how did that come about?
When we started, the first thing we did was get a board of directors together, start some of the paperwork for becoming a nonprofit. And so we didn't have physical land right in the beginning, and it took us almost a year to find the location where we are now. And it was a combination of factors. One, you know, amount of land we could get for the price was a big one. But also, we didn't want to be so rural and so remote that it would be difficult for people to come, whether they are people who are working on staff, volunteering, or even visiting. And that was a key factor, and something that I learned a lot about when I was in that stage of interning and volunteering, sort of what are the you know, pros and cons of where you're located. And so that was an important thing, that it took a little while to find exactly the right space.
Yeah. But how big a space was it initially that you landed at there?
So the initial purchase was for a little over 16 acres. And then a couple years later, an adjoining property became available, and the sanctuary moved up to 20 acres. And then a few years ago, another adjoining property we were able to purchase. So we have 45 acres at the moment.
Wow. So it was part of that initial process, looking around at what was available nearby, where you thought, hey, if things go well, maybe we could expand here, or maybe we could expand there, versus places that maybe we had established facilities or a business altogether different, maybe, or whatever, where you thought that we couldn't possibly expand that direction because that's really not going to be in the cards for us.
Yeah, I think initially, you know, the 16 acres, we didn't necessarily know or have it as a major goal to expand. So I think it was partially just good luck that the property that we were able to purchase did have some availability for expansion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it sounds like you expanded twice so far, if I follow you correctly. So, I mean, it seems super fortuitous that you were able to do that based on the initial piece that fit all the criteria you had established from the get-go.
Yeah, and I mean, we sort of, for the most recent purchase, we were sort of the ones who instrumented that. So there was a landlocked parcel, and we, over a series of maybe 5 years, sent letters to this person and had our real estate agent sent letters to them to say, you know, we're interested in this. We see it's not being used. We're an adjacent property owner, so it would take care of that problem of being landlocked. And eventually they responded to us. So it was a little bit of persistence on our part that made that happen.
And paid off. Yeah, sounds very good. So early in the film, Paul shares an observation that could amount to a Piedmont Farm sort of guiding principle. It says, animal-centered design is actually really similar to designing for humans. You have your clients and you learn about them and you try to design a unique space around their needs. Paul, can you say more about this and apply it to designing, let's say, the goat house, or pick some other structure at the refuge that you think best illustrates this, for being people who probably haven't seen the film yet?
Yeah. I would say, you know, in design school for architecture that I went to, most all of the designs we were doing were based on human clients. They were, you know, made up human clients usually, but they usually had a certain criteria of different spaces that they needed, but also you would think about how the spaces related to the habits and the lifestyles of the people that were going to be using the building, and what kind of impressions that would give to the people that were using the building. So, you know, it always had a human-focused, a client-focused basis, the design work we were taught. And basically, I just tried to bring that over into the animal world here and give them the same respect that we would give a human client. So, say, with the goat structures, one of the things we learned about goats is that at nighttime, in the wild, especially feral goats or wild goats, they like to live in mountainous areas. And at nighttime, they like to go up on high outcroppings where they can be safe from predators and also just have a sense of being safe. So we wanted to bring that into their housing. So we designed more of a vertically spacious space rather than a horizontally spacious. So it's a pretty tall house that they live in, and they have all these layers of bunk beds that they can go up into at night. And it's something that the goats just love, and it's become, you know, a integral part of their lifestyle.
Yeah.
And how they live here at the refuge.
They seem so happy when they're sort of zooming around and going up and going down. And I mean, it just seems like they're being goats, which of course I'm sure is always the goal of any sanctuary, but this seems to take it to a different degree, really catering to, again, what their instincts are, what their pleasures are, and what makes them happy.
Yes. And also what gives them a sense of safety too.
Yeah.
We tend to think about that a lot.
So, Lenore, when did you realize, we kind of touched on this a little bit earlier in the conversation, but that one of your roles in the process was the ongoing sort of voice of reason as Paul generated these highly inventive designs?
Sorry, what was your question?
Just wondering when you realized one of your roles in the process was kind of serving as the voice of reason as Paul generated these.
Yeah, well, I think we sort of naturally just fell into those roles. You know, I was the one that had, you know, spent the years at these other facilities and was starting to learn more of the practical knowledge and, you know, kind of, you know, working with the board of directors and raising the money and doing all that kind of work. And, you know, Paul was so important coming in with not only design skills, but also building skills. And I mean, in those early days, we had work days every week with volunteers coming out to build the chicken and turkey house. You know, there was nothing else to do. We didn't have any animals yet, and people were inspired by the vision. And we couldn't have done that without Paul there to, you know, lead the practical aspect of building those houses and, you know, having that initial design. So I think it was honestly just our personalities as they are in real life, and then them just coming together in a way where we were able to build this place.
Yeah, no, it seems like, because one of the things that's interesting over the course of the film is sometimes you're aiming to rein Paul in, other times you're urging him to think bigger or go bigger, which I guess, again, is just sort of a case-by-case thing, or are you sort of guided by instinct? Because maybe that's a virtue of having been a couple for a long time. You kind of know where to speak up and where to say, hey, this actually is a bit bonkers, or this could actually be bigger and should be for financial reasons or practical reasons.
Is that— Yeah. And I would also add that, you know, Lenore, with all her experience taking care of animals, one of the first things I do when I'm designing a structure is go to her for kind of like the basics of what the animals need for safety from predators, you know, so it's a big thing to think about. And also the animal caretakers needs, because they have to be in and out every day. Many times we have, you know, high degree of animal care here, and a lot of sanctuaries do too. So that's something really important to design for, is all those kind of human needs too, as the caretakers are coming in and out. But we didn't want to make those the first priority in the design process. We really wanted to think about the animals first. What might they like most in a house, right? If they could design their own house, try to put that first, but also incorporate all those practical aspects that come along with taking care of animals every day in and day out.
Yeah, I think, for example, in the duck and goose houses, their set of doors are quite small and open up just to sort of their height, and they really enjoy that space kind of coming in and out of the house. But, you know, that wouldn't have been practical for caregivers to have to, you know, belly crawl into the house every day to give food or clean or give medication. So there's also a human-sized door so that people can get in and out.
Yeah. No, that's great. So let me just quickly again say, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guests are Lenore Brayford and Paul Drake, co-founders of Piedmont Farm Animal Refuge, a highly innovative animal sanctuary in North Carolina. The pair and their sanctuary are profiled in a major new documentary, Forever Home. You're invited to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So before breaking ground, or maybe even early on, what sort of sanctuaries or other facilities served as models for you or inspiration, places that you really admired, especially, again, in Lenore's case, you had worked and volunteered at a number of sanctuaries or probably places that said, well, when I get my sanctuary, I'm going to be sure to do this or I'm going to be sure not to do this.
Hmm. Yeah. At the time, we were in North Carolina, and so one of the questions was just, what is around us that's accessible and easy for me to engage with? So at that time, there was a pot-bellied pig rescue called Pig Pals. They've since relocated to Virginia. And there was a big cat sanctuary called Carolina Tiger Rescue. And, you know, it might sound kind of, you know, far afield from farm animals, but I was interning there because it was a local opportunity to be engaged with a sanctuary, and ended up working on staff for a number of years as a caregiver. And there's a lot more crossover and knowledge that I gained there than somebody from the outside might initially think. And then also at the time, back in 2012, some of the larger known sanctuaries who actually had internship programs were the ones that I sought out to gain some experience in. And those were Farm Sanctuary in their upstate New York location, and also Woodstock Farm Sanctuary.
Great. So looking at the flip side kind of that question, in a way, are there sanctuaries or other places that have been influenced, as far as you guys can tell, by Piedmont Farm Animal Refuge?
Well, we've, over the years, had a good number of conversations, Zoom calls, phone calls, consultations, in-person consultations, and people even coming here for sort of a mini internship, or, you know, somebody who wants to start a sanctuary, spending a significant amount of time here to, you know, learn and find out what it's like. So that's been really fun. We've got to connect with a lot of different sanctuary founders and people doing great work all over the country. And even Paul's been able to even work with some other sanctuaries who were willing to sort of pay for some of his architectural services to help design new buildings and new structures from the perspective of animal-centered design.
So really that's been a bit of a ripple effect, it sounds like. That's kind of one of the things I was really interested in, is that newer sanctuaries, or even ones that exist, when they come time to remodel that barn or that house or whatever, are they embracing the ideas that you guys have sort of brought to Piedmont Farm?
I would say they're starting to. I know we had some conversations with a sanctuary up north. I think it was in Pennsylvania. I'm forgetting exactly where, but they were building a new goat structure, and I think they ended up getting us more of a kind of a prefabricated one that can be delivered to the site. But then they were able to modify it with some of the ideas that we've used here for the goats, with, you know, adding bunk beds and things like that in there. And so they were able to, you know, in a more accessible way to everyday sanctuaries use the ideas we were doing here. So
yeah,
pretty cool.
I think one of the things that's a little bit unique about our sanctuary is when we got our property, there was absolutely no infrastructure whatsoever. So we had a blank slate. I mean, every road, we had to drill a well, every fence post, every structure here, we had to purchase, build ourselves. And so that provided, I think, a wonderful opportunity and kind of a blank canvas for Paul to work with and imagine, you know, what these structures would look like, where they would be sited, what would make the most sense for the animals, for the caregivers, for visitors. And not every sanctuary is in that position. Many people are, you know, on properties where there's already, you know, maybe an old farm, maybe even an old industrial farm that they are turning into a sanctuary. And, you know, some sanctuaries are quite small, maybe just a backyard or a micro sanctuary like we talked about. So I think what we've tried to do is talk about, well, what are the principles of animal-centered design? What, you know, what is the intention behind that? And it doesn't mean that your structure needs to look like ours does. In fact, it probably shouldn't. If you're probably in a different climate than we are, and it probably needs to be designed differently. But what are the core ideas behind that? And how can you just, even in a small way, start to implement an animal-centered design perspective in how you care for farm animals in whatever situation you're in?
Wouldn't you kind of think at this point, I mean, obviously, there might be a bit of bias on your guys' standpoint from this question in responding to it. But wouldn't you think if you were like Lenore was some years ago, going around learning, trying to get experience, doing internships, and you came across the design methods and buildings and how the animals are affected at Piedmont Farm, wouldn't you think you'd be, assuming there wasn't a financial barrier or some other practical obstacle, wouldn't you think you would sort of say, well, we want to embrace this to whatever extent we can at our sanctuary?
Yeah, I think we would, because we are people who are very excited to learn from others and explore new ideas. And so we actually do a lot of that ourselves, even now, is going to other sanctuaries and learning from them. We do something called the Sanctuary Swap every year that Lenore came up with, I think, where we partner with a sanctuary somewhere else in the U.S. and our staff swaps places so that we can learn from them and they can learn from us.
Oh, what a great idea. Wow, that must be super fruitful.
Yes, it totally is. And also, it can be kind of refreshing since, you know, the animal care here, you know, it's and every place, it turns into a routine and a grind, you know. It's also enjoyable, but, you know, to get to see how somebody else might do it differently and get a fresh perspective on things can really be refreshing.
That's really great. So like anything notable for True Excellence, the refuge structures reflect kind of often thrilling attention to detail. Can you describe some of those details, that like the choices you made in creating houses for the animals who live there, which you describe at one point or another in the film? For example, where a given structure is positioned on the property has something to do with that animal and studying them and what they like and like how things might switch from day to night in terms of light, in terms of heat and cold. I mean, there's so many details that are factored in, which is, to me, really exciting as the film unfolded.
Yeah, I would say that's a big part of what we do here, is try to design structures that can passively heat themselves and passively cool themselves with the flows of nature. So, you know, the sun and the wind, thinking about in the summertime, you want to block the hot sun. We're here in North Carolina. You want a big roof overhang that can block out that hot sun, so you're in the shade all day in the structures. And then in the wintertime, you want to accept as much sun as possible here in North Carolina, and so try to store that heat for the nighttime when it gets really cold. And then with wind flows, it's similar. You know, in the summertime, you want to accept the good breezes and have them come through and air out the structures and cool everybody down. And in the wintertime, you want to block them and let them go over the structures.
Yeah.
And, you know, those are things that, you know, farmers had to think about a lot, too, before we had cheap energy and, you know, oil and gas everywhere. They're principles that have been around architecture for as long as it's been around. and it's really great to get to use those to help the animals here.
Yeah. Go ahead, Paul. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there.
And just like Lenore was saying, you know, the structures that make sense here may not make sense in some other part of the country or part of the world because they have a different climate there.
Right.
So the climate and, you know, the external influences on the structures are just as important as the internal ones of the animals.
But there's other things that, that were striking too as we learn more about how those structures came together and the ideas behind them. For example, in creating the chicken house, so one part of the day the chickens can wander freely and happily, whereas later in the day, not coincidentally, large wings sort of structures fold down, protecting the flock against predators. So, I mean, that to me was so cool and so great. And again, I'm not sure how many other places have similar approaches, but that just struck me as a great way to reflect their activities, what they want to do, and make sure they're totally safe at the same time.
Yes, and it kind of gets at this idea of the daytime structure and the nighttime structure and how they have very different criteria, especially for birds who are so vulnerable to so many predators here. We wanted, you know, with the chickens and turkeys, we wanted in the daytime for that to be as open as possible. So you get airflow and, cooling of the space, and help the indoor air quality for the birds. But then at nighttime, we wanted it to be sealed kind of like a tank.
Yeah. and their wings flap down to protect them in exactly that way. Right.
I think another thing, about what Paul's done with the location of the buildings is thinking about what kind of outdoor habitat the animals have access to. So the goat and sheep houses being right on the precipice of woods and pasture and kind of, you know, respecting the fact that in the wild, these animals have a mix of both those habitats. And we want to make sure, if possible, we can provide both of those habitats for their health, for their enjoyment, for their natural behaviors. And also thinking about, you know, as animals age, because we provide lifelong sanctuary here, if there's a very old arthritic, you know, goat or sheep, and they want to go to the woods, it's not too far from the house. Or if they want to go to the pasture, it's not too far. So they don't have to, you know, traverse a very long way to get to where the rest of the herd is. So just kind of being sensitive about that. And that also just goes back to kind of learning more about who these animals really are and where they came from. I think, you know, Paul taking the time and having the sensitivity to do that is unique. And you learn amazing things. Like, most people don't realize that chickens come from a rainforest environment and they hate wide open spaces. But yet you see, you know, if you do see chickens outdoors, on, you know, small farms or even in some rescues, they often just have an open pasture. And so as we learn more and more, we can improve how sanctuaries care for these animals. And it can be as simple as just planting bushes or trees to make their environment a little bit closer to what they would prefer.
Yeah. Well, I think that sort of almost brings us back around to the beginning of the conversation. We're sort of just about out of time at this point, unfortunately, but it sort of really brings us back to the conversation about Allison and the last pig screening and Paul having that conversation and interesting her in what you were doing then and the impact it's having. And I'm sure its influence is widening out over all kinds of people that are looking to make their sanctuaries better or start a sanctuary and reflect some of those ideas.
Yeah, and Allison's movie, we think, is just such a great, well, Allison herself is such a great communicator. And this movie is really the best way we know of helping other people learn about what we're doing here and understanding kind of where we're coming from. With animal-centered design and all the work that Lenore's put into really planning this great sanctuary. We encourage everybody to to watch it and continue the conversation.
All right, great. Well, this has been Lenora Brayford and Paul Drake from Piedmont Farm Animal Refuge. And the website is piedmontrefuge.org. And the name of the film that we've been discussing also is Forever Home by Allison Argo. So congratulations. Thanks for making the time to join us today on Talking Animals. And keep up all the great work.
Thank you so much for having us.
You bet.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Coming up later in today's program, I'll speak with Christina Antonio of Animal Rescue Coalition, or ARC, about their upcoming ARC Walk a Dog Center extravaganza taking place Saturday, May 3rd at Payne Park in downtown Sarasota. We'll hear those details in just a moment. Right now, though, I'm going to step into the Comedy Corner with a piece from Kyle Kinane called Cat Sneeze in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
Like, this is where I'm at socially, if to explain where I'm at on the social spectrum. I recently said God bless you to a cat. Like, I was alone in a room with a cat for a while. Like, not even just a brief moment, like an incident. Like, this was a whole afternoon. Not my room, not my cat. But I was fine with this arrangement. Like, this is what I can handle. Me and somebody else's cat, both of us just staring at walls, looking for answers. And the cat sneezed, and then it was quiet. And that's what made it worse. So if it would have just sneezed, it would be like, oh, God bless you. And then, well, you don't need that. You're a cat. We would have laughed. It would have been fine. But instead, there was a sneeze. And then it was just that moment of just me saying, like, how do I play this right now? Do I say something? I was raised right. I have loving, porno shopping parents that instilled values in me. It's like, yeah, but it's a cat. F*** it, I'm going for it. So I turned to it. It's like, God bless you, cat. I didn't even know its name. I was just opening up for once. It's like, God bless you, cat. And the cat turned and looked at me, because that's what cats do. They look at the origin of sound. But they have very judgmental faces. So everything in that cat's expression was like, why would you say that?
All right, that's Kyle Kinane in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals with a portion of a piece called Cat Sneeze, taken from a set on Comedy Central. Now it's time to speak with Christina Antonio of Animal Rescue Coalition, or ARC, about their ARC Walk event coming up early May. To learn more, let's welcome Christina herself on Talking Animals on Denver. Good morning, Christina.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks.
Excited to be here.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals. So maybe we could start by asking you just to provide a very brief overview of Animal Rescue Coalition, a bit of quick history, mission, and so on.
Sure. So, yeah, I work with the Animal Rescue Coalition, or ARC Spay and Neuter Specialists, and we're based in Sarasota, and we serve pet owners, rescues, and communities throughout the surrounding areas. So at our core, we're a nonprofit veterinary clinic, and we focus on one really powerful idea, and that's spay and neuter is the most effective way to reduce animal overpopulation and prevent suffering before it even begins. You know, a lot of people think that animal welfare starts in shelters, but honestly, the most impactful work happens way before the animals even get there. Every year, thousands of dogs and cats end up in shelters, and many of those situations could have been prevented. So at ARC, we provide affordable, high-quality spay and neuter surgeries and wellness care to pets in the community, especially for families who might not otherwise have access to it. And what that really means is fewer unwanted litters, fewer animals living on the streets, and ultimately more pets staying in loving homes and where they belong. So although I am new to ARC, we've been doing this work since 1999, and today we help thousands of animals every year, averaging around 6,000 surgeries annually.
Wow. Well, that's super impressive, and I'm sure part of the reason way that that's funded is events like the Art Walk. So let's talk a little bit about the Art Walk, and starting with just the facts. It's happening, if I'm not mistaken, Saturday, May 3rd from 9 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. at Payne Park in downtown Sarasota, correct?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay.
So that's really a big reason why we created the upcoming event, Art Walk. So, yeah, it's happening Sunday, May 3rd at Payne Park, which is downtown Sarasota. And it's designed to really just bring the community together around the mission in a way that feels really uplifting and accessible. It's a free event, community 5K walk, or you could run. So
we call those events unticketed in our business.
Unticketed, yes. Yeah. Unticketed event, although you can RSVP on our website. But, yeah, you can participate however you're comfortable, whether that's walking with your dog or jogging with your friends or just coming out to support the cause. We'll have food trucks. We'll have free dog treats. We'll be doing two different raffles, one for winning a cat basket and one for a dog basket. It's just going to be a really great atmosphere where animal lovers can connect.
Sounds really fun.
Yeah. And beyond the fun, the purpose is to raise awareness and support for affordable spay and neuter services, because that's what truly makes a long-term difference.
Even though it's unticketed, Christina, do people donate or does it generate funds to help the ARC's mission?
Yep. You can certainly donate. We'll be selling T-shirts for the event. If you RSVP, you can get a T-shirt for just $15, which is $5 less than what we'll be selling during the actual event. So it's a really fun way to kind of get the community involved.
That sounds fantastic. Well, again, that's the ARC Walk, May 3rd, Payne Park in downtown Sarasota, getting underway at 9 a.m. with all kinds of cool fun and activities and great, great mission. So thank you so much, Christina, for joining us on Talking Animals.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
You bet. Take care. Coming up on WNF, it's The Conversation, the great show hosted by Mario Nunez and Joe King Carter. After that, it's The Scoop. WNF's brief news recap. Then we shift back to music programming with Sam Vall holding forth from 1 to 3, followed by Nancy C hosting the Wednesday Traffic Jam from 3 to 6 p.m., and more great music, of course, all throughout the day and evening after that on 88.5 WMNF. We have just reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals. Next Wednesday, March 25th, I'll be joined by Kevin Nealon, the veteran comedian, longtime animal advocate, and former SNL star. We'll be chatting with Kevin, and you can too, of course, prior to his show, The Side Splitters, in Tampa on March 27th and 28th. So that's next Wednesday, the 25th, here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Invited to join us for that conversation. I also invite you to visit talkanimals.net for audio archives of every show we've ever broadcast. Apple Podcasts are available there too, as well as on other podcast platforms. Also, links to our social media pages. Subscribe to our newsletter to find out about our guests a couple of days beforehand and other news from the Talking Animals world. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thank you very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. This is Talking Animals on WNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weeki Wachee, and beyond. Stay tuned for The Conversation coming up shortly after NPR News.